From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We start the hour with the impeachment inquiry. House Democrats today requested to hear later this week from acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney in the inquiry, and we're expecting to learn more about what two of the most prominent witnesses told lawmakers in closed-door testimony last month about efforts to pressure Ukraine into investigating Democrats, including Joe Biden, for President Trump. Transcripts are due out from depositions by Ukraine envoy, former Ukraine envoy Kurt Volker, and EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland. Let's get the latest from Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olorunipa. Hi, Tolu.
Hi, good morning.
Well, first of all, what do you make of the news that the committees now want to hear from Mick Mulvaney, and do you think he'll comply?
I do not think he will comply, but there is a reason that the committees are trying to get Mick Mulvaney to testify, because he has firsthand knowledge of a lot of the things that they're investigating. They're investigating whether the president held up a crucial White House meeting and $400 million in military aid to Ukraine as a part of this scheme to get political dirt on Joe Biden and other political enemies from the Ukrainians. Mick Mulvaney was the White House chief of staff during the crucial moments when this was happening, and other people who have testified have named him. So the committees are trying to find out whether or not Mick Mulvaney can provide additional information about what was behind this scheme, how involved he was, what the president was trying to accomplish and achieve, and whether or not he would implicate the president or any of the other people within the White House for carrying out what appears to be this quid pro quo. You have to remember that Mick Mulvaney basically admitted on live television that there was a quid pro quo during a press briefing a couple of weeks ago.
Said it happens all the time.
He said it happens all the time. He said, get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy. He tried to walk back some of those comments, but the damage had already been done. And now it does appear that, in part because a lot of his deputies have refused to testify, that he also likely will refuse to testify as part of this impeachment inquiry.
Let's talk about the transcripts due out today. One comes from Gordon Sondland, who's a political appointee, big donor to President Trump's inauguration. And he wrote that famous text to Ambassador William Taylor, who was raising questions about what was going on between the president, the administration, and Ukraine. And Sondland shut down the conversation, saying, let's talk rather than text. What are you going to be looking for in his transcript?
I'll be looking for some inconsistencies, because we've heard from the opening statements of other witnesses, including Ambassador Bill Taylor, that they did have concerns that there was a quid pro quo, that the president was trying to exchange military aid and a White House meeting for these political investigations by Ukraine. Now, Ambassador Sondland apparently told Congress that he did not believe that that was the case, or at least that he was relaying the president's message. He had talked to the president and relayed to Ambassador Taylor that the president did not believe there was a quid pro quo. But I'll be looking to see whether or not there is some daylight between what he has said and what some of the other witnesses have said, and whether or not there will be an attempt by him or any other witness to try to clarify that, because these depositions happened under oath. Mm-hmm. And if he is denying the central allegation that there was this quid pro quo for military aid linked to political investigations, and several other witnesses are saying that that was the case, then he may be forced to try to clarify what he had said, or figure out whether or not he will be brought back before Congress to clear the record and make it clear that he had not attempted to mislead the Congress. I also have heard through reporting that there were a lot of instances in his testimony where he said, I do not recall certain instances and events that happened just over the summer. So I'll be looking for how evasive he may have been during this testimony about what he remembered and what he did not remember.
And what about the other transcript we're waiting for? That would be former Ukraine envoy Kurt Volker. What are you going to be looking for there?
Yes, Kurt Volker actually resigned and left his post. So I'll be looking for whatever he said about what he was doing shortly before he resigned. He was involved in some of these text messages between Ambassador Taylor and Ambassador Sondland. Explaining what he was saying on these text messages about trying to link a White House meeting, a White House call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine with these investigations that Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, was pursuing, and how he seemed to have said that he was caught in between the official foreign policy of the U.S. and the shadow foreign policy that was being carried out by Rudy Giuliani. Kurt Volker had a lot of conversations with Rudy Giuliani, and he said it was a bad situation that he was trying to manage, but I'll be looking to see how he managed that balancing of those two different foreign policies and whether or not he implicates the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, with a shadow foreign policy that he was pursuing.
Totally. Just very briefly, is the White House nervous because of these releases of transcripts each day this week?
Yes, they have no visibility into what was happening behind these closed-door testimony. So they're finding out about this along with the rest of us, and they haven't been able to put together a strategy to counter this narrative that's been growing. So they are a little bit nervous, and they're nervous also about the public testimony that will take place because so far they do not have any Republicans that are standing up and giving them a good narrative to counter the narrative that the Democrats have put together.
Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's pivot to Iowa, as many Democrats running for president are, with less than 3 months until caucuses in this state that leads the nominating process. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg just finished a campaign tour in Iowa yesterday. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters reports on how Buttigieg is drawing sharp contrasts with Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's been rising in the state's polls.
A band played while hundreds gathered in the rain at a rally for Pete Buttigieg last Friday in Des Moines. They were there ahead of the Liberty and Justice celebration, a marquee fundraiser for the Iowa Democratic Party where candidates are looking for a breakout moment. Joe Schmidt from West Des Moines was at the rally beforehand. He recently changed from Republican to Democrat. Schmidt says he's leaning towards supporting Buttigieg in the caucuses.
And again, just his approach that he's pragmatic, more centralist, where he's not going too far in one direction, and he's trying to bring people together. That means a lot.
Afterwards, Buttigieg's supporters, who were there from all over the country, marched to the arena.
I-O-W-A, Mayor Pete, all the way.
13,000 Democratic supporters, activists, and campaign organizers attended. Like Buttigieg, a lot of the candidates held their own rallies ahead of the event. Vicki Stout from suburban Des Moines was at Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' rally. Stout says she's trying to decide between Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Buttigieg. She acknowledges the mayor is a different kind of candidate, but he represents the next generation of Democrats.
And I would like somebody that can bring our country's people together, right? Rather than have the divisiveness that we have now with our current administration.
This fundraiser helped propel then-Senator Barack Obama to win the Iowa caucuses in 2008. All of the candidates wanted to have a similar performance. Buttigieg was the first of 13 presidential candidates to speak.
But I also will not tire from the effort to include everyone in this future we are trying to build. Progressives, moderates, and Republicans of conscience who are ready for a change. The time has come.
A New York Times poll out that same day showed Buttigieg surging to third place in Iowa, passing former Vice President Joe Biden and narrowly trailing Senators Sanders and Warren. The poll showed Iowa Democrats prefer a nominee who supports improving the health insurance system rather than replacing it. It also found most Democrats favor someone who would work with Republicans. The next day, Warren spoke just before Buttigieg at a fundraiser in Cedar Rapids. She presented herself as a bold progressive fighter.
We're not going to do this by kind of nibbling around the edges. We're not going to do it by running some vague campaign with a bunch of slogans that have been approved by consultants not to offend anyone.
That speaks to Maddie Chenal. Chenal is a college student, and she'll be participating in her first Iowa caucus in February. She and her dad didn't stick around for Buttigieg. I talked to them as they were leaving.
I feel like Democrats win elections when they have a clear vision of America. And Elizabeth Warren paints that vision of America so clearly. And she's not saying what we can't do, which I feel like some candidates have said. She's saying, like, this is what we can do, and this is what the vision is, this is what the goal is.
This was the second trip here Buttigieg invited the press onto his campaign bus for a several-day rolling on-the-record conversation. Buttigieg was asked to comment on whether Warren could stop fighting in Washington if she were president.
Well, I think when you become president, you have to figure out a way to bring people together. The case I'm making in my campaign is that I'm best positioned to do it.
Buttigieg held several town halls in Iowa counties that voted for President Obama in the 2008 and 2012 general elections and then voted for President Trump in 2016. He drew sizable crowds in small towns like Decorah and Charles City. After one in Waverly, Sonia Carlson said she was inspired by what Buttigieg had to say about working together as a country regardless of your beliefs.
We're moved to tears a little bit because So our 8-year-old really is the one who wanted to come today the most. He like thinks Mayor Pete's pretty cool. And he convinced us all today that I think he could really be the right person to get us back towards some community-minded, you know, change and movement.
But the Democratic contenders are all on the hunt for support. Bernie Sanders is looking to gain from his endorsement from Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's going to join him for rallies here this weekend. Former Vice President Joe Biden is continuing to campaign here, too. He presents himself as the best bet for beating President Trump in 2020. And a set of new polls from the New York Times and Siena College supports that. For now, Warren and Buttigieg are both enjoying a surge they hope they can ride to a victory on a cold night in early February. For Here and Now, I'm Clay Masters in Des Moines.
One of the pleasures of reporting is the people you get to meet, and one of my favorites was a baker.
The bread is the blood of my vein. Even when people in streets say something about bread or bakery, you know, I think they are pronouncing my name.
Because the name is Poilon, Lionel Poilon, whose father Pierre founded the family bakery in Paris in 1932 with a bread starter lovingly tended since then. The Poilon bread was different from white French breads. As Alice Waters writes, these were rugged loaves made to anchor a meal. Later, you can see part of my visit in the mid-90s with Poilon in his gorgeous bakery at hereandnow.org. I was far from the only one he enchanted. Salvador Dali made bread sculptures like a chandelier for the old stone bakery. In Pierre Poilon's day, artists who couldn't pay for their bread paid with paintings that still adorn the walls. Then into this French fairy tale came tragedy. Lionel loved helicopters and was piloting his wife Irene in one when it crashed in 2002. Both were lost, and leaving behind two daughters, the oldest Apollonia, just 18. Well, she took over the bakery, starting while she was at Harvard. Now she has a new book, Poilon, The Secrets of the World-Famous Bread Bakery. We spoke before, so I could ask if I could play her father's voice. And Apollonia, I hope it was okay to hear it.
It was wonderful. I love my father's French accent in English, and I have definitely mocked him with my sister. It's lovely to hear his passion and his eagerness to share his love for his craft.
Well, and tell us about that, because he once said when he took over the company from your grandfather, he didn't want to be trapped in this intellectual cupboard, this underground universe, completely removed from the outside life. But then as you write, he made it so much more than bread. Describe how your father transformed even more than your grandfather had a bakery.
So you have to imagine that on 8 Rue du Cherche Midi, there's a small brick-clad storefront, and in the basement, you have the bakehouse with a 100-ton heavy wood-fired brick oven. We bake the bread by hand, not because we want to do it all the old-fashioned way, but because that is where we have found our balance in baking.
What do you mean by that balance in baking?
Well, my grandfather started a recipe of this country-style loaf. And when you work at the bakery, our process has been perfected over the past 87 years. And my father had been forced by my grandfather to work into the business when he was 14. He was yanked out of school, and that was it. And the revelation for him was that bread connects to the world. Mm. And whereas the popular thought in France was that a baker's job was literally something for people who are tall, strong, and stupid. And he had a different outlook on this. He saw his craft as a link to the world, because bread has fed generations before us. And that is what he shared with us from a very young age with my sister. And that has definitely fueled my passion for my craft and very naturally led me on taking over the family business.
Right. He saw bread as a main ingredient in the culture, politics, philosophy, central experience. People like Salvador Dali would work with your father to make these bread sculptures. I mean, it was feeding all sorts of things, the soul as well as the stomach. And here
you—that's exactly right. 17 years into running the family business, one of the things that I take the most pride in is that for me, bread is not only food for the body, but food for the mind, food for the soul.
Again, when this happened, you were on your way to Harvard and you still went, and yet you were also having Poilane bread shipped in.
I did. Yeah. Every week.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that was a fantastic way of connecting with friends.
Right. So now, continuing the family legacy and coming out with this book, as we say, there's tips on how we all can maybe try to make this same bread, but can we really? Because maybe we're making one or two loaves. The bakery now also in London and with, you know, a larger area where the bread is made. Can we really make the same kind of bread?
In the book, I offer recipes so that people can reproduce the sensory experience of baking bread like we do at the bakery. But you point out exactly the limit of it is that when we bake one loaf or two loaves at a time, we don't have the same volume and we don't also have the same equipment than we do at the bakery. Unless you have that big oven that I was describing previously, you're not going to replicate the exact same environment. What my parents really mastered in building the manufactory is that at a time where they were expanding their distribution, came a time where they were faced with this production dilemma: how do we scale without compromising on quality? And their response was, we'll multiply the bakehouses. So at the manufacture, there are 24 bakehouses, which effectively act as 24 small little independent bakeries, one next to the other. And each baker works on his production from start to finish. Mm. So we can produce anywhere between, on average, 3,000 to 5,000 loaves a day because we increase the number of bakers and the amount of batches according to demand.
Huh. Again, it's just beautiful to see the process. It's an art form in and of itself. But for us, the mere mortals, you have some tips. They include use French salt if you can.
So I use sea salt from Guérande. And what's beautiful with that salt is that if you put it in with the same quantity of another type of salt, you'll just get so much more flavor. And it's very distinctive and it's definitely part of our signature.
You used King Arthur here in the States, testing recipes for all-purpose flour, whole wheat flours, and Bob's Red Mill. You say butter, European butters have a higher fat content. Try to get that if you can. Make sure in the recipes you use either unsalted or salted. Whatever's called for, use what's called for. Weigh the ingredients, especially flour. Also, consider investing in a 12-inch heavy-duty pot with a lid for the sourdough.
It just makes your life easier. And at some point, it's not about cutting corners, but it's about getting the satisfaction of producing that handmade loaf. In many ways, when we're working in the bakehouse, we have the momentum and we have the volume to make our life so much easier than the home baker.
Yeah.
And I think that was the hardest part in creating a recipe for this book, because I've heard all too often people be discouraged by bread baking, despite having a true passion. Having failed a couple of times, have been discouraged to give it a second try. I remember my father would have me hand-knead brioches every morning so that I can get a sense of what it is to hand-knead a loaf. And it was a tremendous learning experience.
Why is it hard?
The delicateness of the ingredients. It's also very messy because you'll have eggs, you'll have butter. And then it's about, as the brioche rise, it's just extremely fragile as a dough. It was so aggravating at first. I was like, but it was so good until then.
Well, you know, you talk about your dad guiding you here. He brought you and your sister when Poilane opened in London. He had you light the ovens. Now, at the time, you weren't that thrilled about this, but you now see this as this almost passing of the torch.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's funny is that despite being very annoyed at being there and pausing for the picture, both my sister and I, and we both felt, however annoying it was, we knew that it would be something that in time we'd come to appreciate. And we did.
Lighting an oven, keeping the starter going. By the way, we should say the book is much more than bread. Sweet potato and sunchoke stuffing there. Forgive me, cookies there. Croissant sandwiches there. But we want to point out one of your father's recipes, a bread sandwich, a sandwich where the filling is bread.
Bread. Because it's that filling and that sustaining. In the book, there are recipes of how to use bread as an ingredient. And that is beyond making bread or some of the Poilane recipes. I wanted to show people that bread can also be a fantastic ingredient. From crust to crumb, my recipes are intended to provide ideas to not toss away bread, because When you know how much time it took to grow the grain, to mill it, to create the bread, I think you just can't just toss it away in the trash.
Everything that happened before your hands touched it. And speaking of which, just a couple of last tips on when you're actually making the bread. You say a baker's touch should, as we say, be gentle enough to avoid breaking the gluten strands that trap the carbon dioxide, which will then rise. The smell, your sense of smell, you know dough is ready to be baked when there's a scent of what, fermentation?
Yes. It's a smell that you want to just like tickle your nose for a second.
You're right. It's like the aroma of cut wood. So people mm-hmm. know what that is. And just finally, is it really true that you can take your knuckles and rap on a loaf of bread and listen to the sound to know if it's fully baked?
Absolutely. And that is the best test to know. You can be misled by the color of the crust. The crust could be entirely burnt and the dough could be barely cooked inside.
Hmm. Apollonia Poilain, I'm sure people have said it to you, but you and your sister, you know, your father's daughters, there's got to be such satisfaction in that.
There is. Growing up, when people turned to my father to ask what I would do later on in life, he would really make an effort of not imposing on us that, so that it could be really be something that came from our hearts and our desire to take over the family business. Mm. And the first time I gave a breath to a loaf, or when I see new generations of bakers, or when I see clients whose children now come to the bakery, I feel a lot of pride in my family's tradition, in that ongoing conversation between past and present.
That's Apollonia Poilain, head of her family's famed Poilain Bakery, her new book, Poilain, Secrets of the World Famous Bread Bakery. Apollonia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can we affect the rise and fall of the economy?
Although things may look good for now, many Wall Street analysts are concerned about the warning signs ahead.
Just by the way we talk about it?
Once again, flashing that ominous recession.
How stories and psychology affect our economic fate. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Today, Mexico's security minister said that 9 people from one American family ambushed and killed by drug cartel members in northern Mexico could have been mistaken for a rival cartel in the area. 3 mothers and at least 6 children were killed. NPR's Carrie Kahn is in Mexico City. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Robin.
Boy, what a horror. You know, some children escaped, were missing.
Yeah.
These were members of the LeBaron family decades ago. They split off from the Mormon church when the church moved away from polygamy. Their deaths reverberating through Utah and other states where they had family. But you've been focusing on what this says about the cartels. What do we know about the claim this might have been a mistake?
Well, all we know is what Mexico's head of security said this morning at an early morning press conference. He gave a timeline of events. It wasn't a very detailed one, but said that it was yesterday around 1 o'clock when these 3 women driving in 3 different vehicles with their 14 children set out from a rural town in Chihuahua, Mexico. They were traveling to another rural town in the neighboring state of Sonora, and both of these northern Mexican states border the U.S. One of the vehicles came under fire. The government said the vehicle was ambushed by an armed gang. That vehicle was incinerated, and in that car was one woman and 4 of her children, including months-old twins. Mm-hmm. As for the other cars, they didn't get very far. They, too, were shot upon, and the other 2 women and the other dead were in those cars. Several of the children, as you said, were hiding for a while before they were saved, and there was one child that had gone missing, but relatives say has now been found.
Good. Well, look, we're reading reports that 2 members of this family were killed about a decade ago because they were speaking out against the drug cartel. So there is, of course, a chance that could be the case here. Relatives in the U.S. are active on social media. They're trying to get answers. But meanwhile, this was about 100 miles south of the border with Arizona. Talk more about the violence in this region.
It is a very conflictive region. Drug gangs are battling for territory. This is a lucrative smuggling route to the U.S. The Mexican president today in his morning press conference didn't want to speculate about the motives, but as he said, the security chief said that it looks like they were mistaken by rival drug gangs. And then the attorney general of the state of Chihuahua spoke to local reporters earlier today, too, and he named a specific group that was possibly involved, and he he's cited multiple past confrontations in this area for these smuggling routes. And he's pointing to a subgroup of the Sinaloa cartel.
Yeah. Well, Mexico's president has been under a lot of criticism for not directly attacking these gangs, despite there have been other high-profile killings in the country. 14 police killed recently. A captured cartel member had to be released when other police holding him came under attack. So what's been reaction to the slaughter of this family?
Well, it is going to put the president under even more criticism and more scrutiny because of his non-interventionist, non-aggressive strategy toward the drug gangs. A lot of people say he doesn't have a strategy at all. You pointed to the attacks last month in Culiacán, Sinaloa, where they actually apprehended then released one of the sons of El Chapo Guzman. The president says he will not continue with the same misguided and failed policies of going after drug kingpins. And what he says is just fighting fire with fire. And he said yesterday's events, the massacre of this extended family, is lamentable, but he will not retreat from his strategy. So we're going to hear a lot more about that.
Well, and President Trump tweeted out, we need to wage war on the drug cartels. But Mexico's president said in a news conference, the worst thing you can have is war. It sounds like at least in some places, they already have it. NPR's Carrie Kahn in Mexico City. Carrie, thank you.
You're welcome.
The air quality in Delhi, India, home to more than 15 million people, is always bad this time of year. But this year, the city's residents are suffering through the worst smog in years. The BBC's Rajini Vaidyanathan is there and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, how bad is it right now with the air quality there?
Well, the air quality is still incredibly bad, but it's much better than it was over the weekend. The air quality index, the AQI, was getting close to 1,000, which is just crazy levels. And now, today, I went out with a pollution meter, and the levels were around, I don't know, maybe 220, 240. They fluctuate depending on where you are. And the levels of PM2.5, which are the small, tiny particles that go deep into your lungs and basically stay there, so they really do deliver long-term damage. They were a lot lower today, but they're still way, way above what is considered a safe level, according to the World Health Organization. So I think I got a reading of something like maybe 180, and the World Health Organization says that something around 50 is considered safe. So while everyone in Delhi is saying, great, things are better, they're still incredibly dangerous.
Well, and I know that you spent some time living in the United States. Did you ever see anything like you're seeing there when you were here?
I didn't, but I have to say, when you live in Delhi, one of the things that's kind of new is that you check on your weather app for the pollution levels. And now I have a separate app just to check the pollution. And what I did find quite interesting is cities like Los Angeles and Chicago that I was looking up last week have fairly high levels. I think Chicago was something around 80 last week, which is still low compared with what I'm seeing here. Mm-hmm. But it does kind of make you realize that actually wherever you live in the world, whether it's India, China, London, or the United States, it is worth being cognizant of the fact that the air we breathe can be quite toxic.
But as you've been reporting over the last week, Delhi recorded its worst overall air quality in years. And it was so bad that trucks were banned from entering the city, construction stopped, schools closed. Is that all still going on?
Yes, I mean, it's still very much a state of emergency, but some of the things that have come in at the start of this week have helped to reduce some of those levels. The Delhi government introduced what they call the odd even scheme, and that basically means that on even dates, cars with a license number ending with an even number, a license plate, should I say, can only drive on the road, and then on odd days, the opposite. And that's reduced traffic, but it's only private vehicles, so taxis can still drive, and there are exemptions. So female commuters can still drive, and there's still so many motorbikes and scooters on the road, which also contribute to the pollution. But you asked me before just how bad it is. I mean, almost apocalyptic scenes where, you know, visibility was very poor at the weekend. A number of flights had to be diverted because the visibility was too bad for them to land in Delhi. And I've never seen anything like it.
And a lot of people had to go to the hospital, right, with respiratory problems.
Yes, and the biggest concern is actually for the elderly and young children. And I interviewed a doctor yesterday. I want to mention this because I think it was quite sort of startling for me. He said to me, the day a baby is born in Delhi, they effectively become a smoker. And I've never, ever smoked a cigarette in my entire life. And now, because I live in Delhi, I am effectively a smoker. I think one of the really important things that I learned moving here was also that the air quality indoors can be as bad as outdoors. I'm actually sleeping in the smallest bedroom because it's smaller, so there's less air. I mean, a lot of people are doing this. These are the kind of strange things that you have to do now to mitigate the pollution. I'm not really living in much of my house because I'm trying to control where I can control the air. If you open a door, the reading can go up. And in many ways, people say, look, you're not really safe at all because the air is everywhere. And that is slightly terrifying for someone who's just moved here about 8 months ago.
Regini, what is the cause of this current bout of air pollution in Delhi?
Well, it's a multitude of things. It's important to say, actually, that this is almost an annual thing now, which sort of begins after Diwali, which is the Hindu festival. And so one of the factors is the pollution from Diwali fireworks going off in the city and the area. The other factors, pollution from motor vehicles and buses and all that kind of thing. There's also fumes from industrial emissions, many which go unchecked. But the other thing that's very specific to now as well are farmers who burn crop stubble to get ready for the new season. They just kind of burn the stubble of the crop in neighbouring states, so in Haryana, Uttar Pradesh and Punjab. And that's where this becomes political, because you've got the state government in Delhi saying it's these farmers in these neighbouring states who are to blame, and not just the farmers, but the politicians who are not doing anything about it. And, you know, Delhi kind of sits almost on a kind of basin, and the winds kind of come in and end up in Delhi. But the Indian Supreme Court saying yesterday that a lot of the things that the politicians are bringing in to do this are gimmicks. We haven't heard too much, interestingly, about this from Prime Minister Modi and the BJP. Of course, he himself living in Delhi. But I wonder what exactly is going to change, and whether next year when I'm in Delhi, we're going to have exactly the same conversation.
That is the BBC's Regini Vaidyanathan joining us from Delhi. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, now to a discovery that scientists say is a consequence of climate change, the world's largest known aquatic dead zone. The area without oxygen is thousands of miles wide in the Gulf of Oman off the southern coast of Iran. These types of oxygen black holes can occur naturally, but now scientists say they are growing faster than usual. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports from the Gulf of Oman.
I'm swimming in an area that's being consumed by the world's biggest dead zone. This is a part of the sea that's almost completely devoid of all oxygen, and it's about the size of the state of Florida. Scientists say it's a catastrophe for marine life because not much can survive here.
Not only is it bad for sea life, it contributes to global warming, and the extent of it has caught scientists off guard.
For us, it was definitely a very big surprise.
Bastian Quest from the University of East Anglia in the UK says he and other scientists from Oman had been on an entirely different research project looking at algae growth in the area. But the underwater robots they were using to collect data kept coming back with strange results.
We saw this picture of the really low oxygen come back, and we were like, are the sensors not working? Are the calibrations wrong? Generally in science, when you get a result that you think, wow, this is exciting, this is game-changing, it generally means you've done something wrong.
But the results weren't wrong. The oxygen minimum zone, as Quest calls it, covers almost all of the 63,700-square-mile Gulf of Oman, and it goes down hundreds of metres below the surface. Sometimes these occur naturally in seas and oceans. This one may go back to the 1980s, but now it's expanded vastly. And the reason for that, Quest believes, is climate change.
One thing that we've seen since the 80s is really a big shift in weather patterns, in warming, in winds, and so very related to climate change.
Quest says the water on the surface now gets so hot that it doesn't mix well with the cooler water beneath, and that forms a boundary that stops oxygen from reaching the seawater below. Runoff from fertilizer and other forms of pollution can exacerbate the problem.
It's a really dangerous system that we really have to understand because it has impacts on so many different things.
For one thing, he says, once formed, these oxygen black holes can actually make climate change worse. When there's little oxygen, bacteria in the seabed switch to living on a chemical that produces nitrous oxide, a greenhouse gas that's 300 times more powerful than carbon dioxide emissions. And then there's the impact on sea life. fish seek the small layer of oxygen on the surface, which makes them vulnerable to overfishing. The lack of oxygen might also make them migrate elsewhere. Back on the boat in the Gulf of Oman, Salah Al-Mashari, a local skipper who worked with Quest and his Omani colleagues, tells me his family already feels the consequences of this change. His brother is a fisherman and relies on the sea.
Sometimes the fishermen, they are going out for around 100 miles away from the coast, you know, so they spend a lot of petrol. So they come back without any fish. Next day, they are going again. So that's very difficult for him. If there is no fish, so how can they feed the family? So all the life from the sea.
As we near the coast, we pass young boys who leap from high rocks into the water. And just beyond them sits the fishing harbour, around which this Omani village is organised. Without fish, Mashari worries. He doesn't know how this community, and many others like it, can continue to survive. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Gulf of Oman.
Yesterday, Oklahoma carried out what's believed to be the largest commutation in the country ever, releasing more than 400 prison inmates behind bars for low-level nonviolent drug charges and other crimes. Prison reform advocates are applauding, but with some reservations. Steve Bickley is the executive director for Oklahoma's Pardon and Parole Board. He oversaw yesterday's emotional release. And Steve, first, what was that like?
It was absolutely a memorable day. When you see people reunited with their family and moms getting to hug their daughters and parents hugging their children, it was truly, sometimes there wasn't a dry eye around.
Yeah. Well, we have a clip. Here's Lena Lemus, one of 13 inmates released from Cape Bernard Correctional Center in Oklahoma City. She spoke to KOCO Channel 5 News. Let's listen.
That's the great thing that the governor's doing, you know, so we can be home with our kids. You know, I've been out of her life for 3 years, but she's my hope. She's never given up on me.
And then you heard the yelling in the background as people saw other loved ones. And so, Steve, this was the governor's, Kevin Stitt, who campaigned on a promise of reducing the prison population in Oklahoma, which, as you know, has passed Louisiana as, you know, the largest prison population per capita in the country. Tell us a little bit about Governor Stitt's thinking behind what happened yesterday.
Well, he made criminal justice reform one of the planks that he got elected on, and fundamentally doesn't believe that Oklahomans are the worst people in the world, which is what the incarceration rate would say. And so he believes that we have a systemic issue, and he's working to fix that. But there are about 900 inmates that were on the docket, and we worked with the DA so that the ones that they were really worried about didn't get out.
I think he said something while he was campaigning to the effect of, we're putting people in prison because we're mad at them and not because, you know, there's not another way to handle this. And it's also going to be saving money, I think something like $11 million?
Yeah, just shy of $12 million is what it would have cost us to continue to incarcerate those inmates till they got released.
Yeah. But people might be wondering, well, you've let these people who had these low-level charges, and I think across the country there's an agreement that perhaps shouldn't have been in prison in the first place. Other states are also commuting sentences for these very low-level drug charges. But how have they been prepared for coming out of prison?
Yeah, one of the goals, well, the goal was never just the simple release of inmates, but the goal all along was the successful reentry of these inmates back into society. And so as we started talking about this, the nonprofits rallied around and said, we've got to make sure that they have every opportunity for success. And the Department of Corrections held their first ever transition fairs. We invited all the nonprofits into the prison to tell the services that they offered these releasing inmates. And nonprofit after nonprofit got up in front of the inmates and said, I'm here to help you with housing. I'm here to help you with transportation. I'm here to help you with a job. And they got connected with those resources. And we went farther than just that, knowing that one of the first things an inmate has to do upon release is get a state-issued ID. So we did that while they were incarcerated. Mm-hmm. We figured out a way to get them all to the Department of Public Safety's and get them issued driver's license or state-issued ID so that the moment they walk out, another barrier had been reduced for their successful reentry.
Yeah, these transition fairs, I think, were at 28 facilities across the state. But as you know, people who are applauding this bipartisan effort, led by your Republican governor and many Republican lawmakers, didn't go as far as many hoped. There were more than a dozen bills proposed. They would shorten drug sentences, limit the use of cash bail, a big problem. People might be brought in for one thing and then they stay in jail because they don't have the cash bail. Ease reentry into society for former prisoners, reduce the use of lengthy terms for people repeatedly convicted of nonviolent crimes, the same crime. But we understand that prosecutors in the state and some law enforcement officials and bail bond companies lobbied against that. Do you think the state has more to do?
Oh, there's no doubt. Our governor has formed a task force. And I think what is really monumental about what just took place is it was a first step. And overwhelmingly, everyone said it was the right step. And I think we can build upon that. And I think it'll create more momentum for more criminal justice reform in Oklahoma.
And is there a feeling in Oklahoma, it sounds like, as there is across the country, that the notion of the three strike laws, partially repealed, we know, in 2015 in your state, but, you know, put in the 1980s, this idea of three drug offenses and you had to have life in prison and they could have been low level offenses, that is just wrongheaded?
Well, I think what we're saying is that incarcerating a drug addict isn't the right solution. And I think we're recognizing that with smarter legislation, better sentencing, more treatment options up front, drug court. There's a host of activities that are working to try to keep people out of the system.
Yeah. Steve Bickley, Executive Director for Oklahoma's Pardon and Parole Board, as the state yesterday released over 400 inmates, low-level drug charges and nonviolent crimes. Steve, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young. We're at home with composer Osvaldo Golahov as he works on his new piece about a man who walks to find his son who's died.
Here is just, you know, one foot lightly lifts from the earth the other, and we are all walking together and nobody knows who is carrying whom.
Falling Out of Time, next time,
one,
Here and Now.
Three, four, five, one, two, three, one, two.